Welcome to Scuttlebutt, the official podcast of the National Museum of the Surface Navy in affiliation with the Surface Navy Association's Battleship Iowa chapter. Coming to you from the Associated Foundation's Training Center aboard Battleship Iowa. We are back with part two of our conversation with Sal from What's Going On with Shipping. And if you haven't checked out his channel yet, it is linked in the description. It's really good stuff. Go give it a look. But after you finish this podcast, so in the room we have Iowa's COO and various other titles, Mike Getcher, our development director, Kyle Abbey, and me, Marianne Fengler. I run comms. We left off with Sal talking about maritime law. Let's get back into it.
Yeah, I've even had a kind of a curious question about if we were in fact hit by a vessel and we were more or less stripped off the dock, are we a vessel not under command? Where does salvage rights come into that? And plus the contract with the Navy is really unique. We literally own the vessel, Sal. We own a battleship. Raise your hand if you own one. But if the Navy wants it back, they can take it back.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the Navy provision on all the ships. I mean, that's the same thing. I remember being at a maritime history conference where they talked about that. They have no overview of the ships, but we have the right to take them back at any moment.
What's interesting, too, is they've stepped away from the liability as well, because they used to have an inspection process, which really didn't help all that much. It was a little bit helpful at times, but they've even backed away from that. So they don't have any direct ties. They don't want to get in trouble. The Navy doesn't want to get in trouble with these. That's all there is to it.
But, well, I mean, then, you know, ships have unique distinctions under maritime law. You can arrest a ship. And so, you know, sure, the ship can be held liable for all the costs associated with it. You know, that's what happened to Ever Given. When Ever Given grounded in the Suez, the Egyptians arrested it, charged it with $916 million worth of funds. You know, there was a $300 million in salvage. There was $300 and something million in additional above and repairs to the canal. And then my favorite was $300 million for offending the canal, which is literally what they said. They said, you know, you did dishonor to the canal by doing this, which was the best. That was the best one. It was absolutely perfect. Yeah.
You've offended me. You know, Sal, interestingly, too, because of the Dolly incident, we've reached out to a couple of maritime attorneys who are local. We have connections in L.A., and interestingly, one of the first ones we contacted said, well, you know, if we ever have an elision here, we don't want to be in conflict. So we're going to stay out of this one. We just wanted to get some advice on what our position might be if we get hit.
Yeah. Matter of fact, I just heard from the John Brown, which is the Liberty ship up in Baltimore. They had to cancel a sale, which they were going to do in May. So, I mean, there may be a suit that they can levy against the Dolly for loss of wages and money for that.
So, yeah, liquidated damages. There's a lot of impact.
Not to mention
The liability issues. You know, when I did that video, I wasn't kidding. You're talking about $2 to $3 billion is about the good ballpark they're looking at here in terms of that. You know, the easiest liability is when the ship sinks out in the ocean. You've got ship costs. You got cargo costs. That's a nice flat number. You can figure that out. It is the unintended consequences of events with shipping that has it. Whenever Given had the grounding, I remember talking to an insurance guy. It's like, well, we worst cased a scenario where a container ship ran into a passenger ship. And, you know, we had all the liability from that. And we figured that's the worst case liability we could ever come to, where, you know, thousands died. You lost two ships. That was the worst case. And then they said Ever Given happened. It's like, nope, this is the worst case, because we delayed 400 ships. And everyone who had goods on all those ships were suing. I mean, they're still litigating this. It's 3 years later, and the litigation isn't even close to being done.
Yeah, that's crazy. Liquidated damages. It's the unintended consequences. Plus the offense.
Right.
Part of the offense.
I have to think about something coming in here this morning about how disconnected the population in general is from shipping. I mean, shipping is something that has been going on. Like, you know, you talk about maritime archaeology. How many shipwrecks from back in the day carrying amphorae and whatever? It's been there forever. And average people just have zero connection with it. They have no idea where all their goods come from. That's one of the things that we're trying to bring attention to here, and that and the Navy's role in protecting all of it.
Yeah, you know, the maritime historian and the nautical archaeologist in me and the material culture guy in me have been, you know, talking about this. You know, if I had my druthers, had the time, I could do it. It would be to set up kind of almost like you see with the guided tour rides, but do that around the U.S. going to ships and going to museums, where you talk about the evolution of, you know, shipping, you know, in the history of the United States, because I think it would be absolutely fascinating to, you know, use the backdrop of the historical vessels we have and talk about it. Because, again, it's an amazing history. But the problem is, over the past 50 years or so, Americans have been largely detached from the sea. What they have seen is the Navy. That tends to be the one aspect. So you get tours on Iowa because it's an Iowa class battleship. It's a big honking battleship. People like it. I like the guns. I like big 16 inch 50 calibers. It's great. It's fantastic. I love these things. But at the same time, it's understanding, you know, you're right there across from a working port. And then you literally have, you know, sea power encapsulated right there.
Yeah.
You've got the military side. You've got the commercial side. I was just in a conference yesterday talking with Nick Lambert, who just came out with a brand new book on reinterpreting Mahan and Mahan's definition of sea power. And it's fantastic because Nick says basically what my interpretation has been for Mahan for a long time is that he's talking about the understanding of sea power is commercial and military. That's the thing. It's trade. It's all about trade. Yeah. And in many ways, what Iowa and the class were created to do was ensure the free trade of the United States, was to ensure that the U.S. could move its goods around because the Japanese were creating a closed environment in which they were going to operate. And, you know, that's the key. And how do you educate people on that? Well, museum ships are great. Online programs are great. But, you know, one of the things that I think people learn more than anything else, this Friday, I'm taking my Civil War class to a Civil War battlefield near me.
Nice.
Because the way you learn is by going out and seeing and touching the ground.
Yes.
Or going to a ship. You know, I could take you out in a boat and go teach you the Battle of the Philippine Sea, but it doesn't really matter. You're in a boat. Water looks the same everywhere. It doesn't matter where I go. But if you do it from the deck of Iowa and talk about Philippine Sea, you can do that right there because that ship was in it. It was there. And I think that's a really important aspect. And I think we don't do a good enough job. I always talk about this. We don't do a good enough job educating people in maritime history or using the resources we have, whether it's a battleship like yours, or it's the underwater wrecks up in Lake Huron off of the NOAA Sanctuary in Alpena, which are absolutely fantastic to look at because they're perfectly preserved because it's fresh water. And you can literally see a wooden sailing ship from the 1850s sunk with a mast still standing up. It's incredible. You have to go like to the Black Sea to see something like that. And, you know, what the more we do to integrate those programs together and literally create the you know, the tour route of people so that they can go from different places. They can go to the Monitor at Mariner's Museum. They can go to the Baltimore, which go up in the Baltimore and go see Constellation, the last wooden sailing vessel built for the U.S. Navy. Go to Philadelphia and go see Olympia. Go to Los Angeles, see Iowa. Go up to San Francisco, go see Jeremiah O'Brien. You know, these are the things that I think would be fantastic. And have them linked together into a program. And again, this is me just dreaming about these things.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love
that. You're speaking our language too, the whole freedom of the seas thing. And of course, the National Museum of the Surface Navy is really born of the fact that essentially the largest community in the Navy did not have its own museum. You know, we kind of stumbled into this, but this is critical. And we're going to open it in 2025, the initial portion of that, which is the 250th anniversary of the beginning of the U.S. Navy. And if you think about it, what has really changed in 250 years? We're still fighting pirates. We're still dealing with everything else. The freedom of the seas is still a legitimate discussion.
Hey, before Dolly has its incident, you know, one of my features have been almost continually talking about the Red Sea and highlighting destroyers like Mason and Kearney and Gravely and Laboon and all the ones that are there. And basically, you know, doing an anti-piracy mission because the Houthis are not a state act. They're not a state actor. They're not Yemen. They're a faction. This is Barbary pirates, you know.
Yeah.
And again, you know, where does the U.S. Navy start? Well, Ian Tull, six frigates, Constellation, up in Boston. That's where it starts. It's a defend commerce mission.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Navy Surface Warfare Group is embracing this right now. They're looking at this, you know, I get a little hard on the Navy at times because they're not talking about this enough, in my opinion. I think they need to be talking more about it, you know, because they're out there every day shooting down drones, shooting down missiles, really emphasizing it so that when they make an argument down the future for new surface combatants, this should be their role model. Because what we're going to see is a proliferation of this. We're going to see piracy proliferate like the Houthi with drones, with missiles, with ballistic missiles. You know, as long as there are actors who want to cause problems, we're going to have it. We have lived under freedom of the sea since post-World War II. I mean, there's been that concept, and everyone has benefited from that. You know, we have made shipping so inexpensive that you can move goods around the planet. And since 1945, there's been very few impediments to that. They've been isolated. We've seen them. We've had issues with it, but nothing large scale. Now, we're, for the first time, I would argue, you know, we're seeing disruptions on a global scale of shipping. COVID was the first one, and now we're seeing it in the Black Sea between Russia and Ukraine. We're seeing it in the Red Sea with the Houthi. We're seeing it in the South China Sea. And my concern is we will see it on the Blue Sea between some other factions. And what does that mean for not just the U.S., but for global trade?
Yeah, absolutely. Huge questions. Yeah.
You recently did a podcast on the Navy's 30-year shipping plan. Talk a little bit about that.
So first of all, let me be clear. I joke about the Navy 30-year shipping plan because this is a requirement from Congress. And let's be clear. If the Navy had a 30-year shipping plan in 1890, it wouldn't have included dreadnoughts. If they had one in 1910, it wouldn't have had aircraft carriers. If they had one in 1940, it wouldn't have had nuclear ballistic submarines in it. Right. So, you know, predicting 30 years out is a tough thing. But, you know, we just had the story come out. USNI News published a story that the Constellation frigate, named again for some of the first frigates coming out. These are the new guided missile frigates based on a foreign design, the Fremm frigate, is going to be 3 years late. You know, it was supposed to be 2026. Now it's 2029. And I think shipbuilding has taken a huge hit in the United States.
Absolutely.
In the 1970s and 80s, we basically divested ourselves of building commercial ships. We deregulated the industry. We got rid of the subsidies, which I know no one likes to talk about. But we got rid of the subsidies. But the problem is other countries embrace them. And if you look at China, Japan, Korea, that's how they do it. They build 94% of the world's ships. China alone builds 44%. Just one company in China builds 20% of the world's ships. And the U.S. has suffered for that. I mean, right up from where you are on your side of the river right there was huge shipyards that were being built that built ships during World War II. I mean, absolutely essential. The namesake of Mercy was built right there. So, I mean, you were building ships right there in Los Angeles, in Long Beach, like crazy. And what we have done is basically outsourced them. We outsourced them because, again, we lost that, you know, sea blindness came in. We lost the visibility. The Navy viewed a Navy as a power projection force. We're going to launch from the shore, from the sea to a shore. Did it in Korea, did it in Vietnam, did it in the Persian Gulf War, did it in Iraq, did it in Afghanistan. Well, today the challenge is what you're seeing in the Red Sea and the Black Sea. And I think we have to reorient ourselves. And probably having a shipbuilding capacity in the U.S. commercially would be a benefit. If you look at Japan, China, and Korea, right next to tankers and container ships and LNG carriers and cruise liners, they're building cruisers and destroyers and frigates and submarines. This is the thing that kind of plagues our shipbuilding industry because the shipbuilding industry in the U.S. has one customer. It's the U.S. Navy. And when you have one customer, you have to kind of do what that customer wants. And I think we really need to take a moment and take a look at, you know, prior to World War II, what led you to Iowa and the Iowa-class battleships? The reason you build those battleships is because the U.S. passes the Merchant Marine Act of 1936, which tries to restart shipbuilding in the United States. When commercial companies didn't have the money or resources, the U.S. began a government program. We built 50 ships in a year, and the plan was to build 500 ships across 10 years. And in Newport News Shipyard, they built the very first ship in that program was SS America, big, huge cruise line. And down the way in Newport News went that. And right behind her on the way went Indiana battleship, then the Yorktown, CB-10, which is in Charleston right now. And, you know, the Two Ocean Navy Act of 1940, which brings you Iowa, would have been completely unsuccessful if you didn't have the shipyards up and running building commercial vessels, because what they did is transition to building Navy vessels, and then they broke off little pieces, little baby shipyards off from each other to build it. So Newport News built a yard in Wilmington, North Carolina, and they build Liberty ships down there. Zebulon Vance, very first Liberty ship, comes down the ways on December 6th of 1941, very apropos day.
Yeah. Again, you're speaking the same language that we do here. Yeah, I did one of my roles is the preservation committee chair for Historic Naval Ships Association, just taking care of the museum ships across the nation, just making presentations. I did a presentation this last year at the conference, and discussing where could we actually dry dock an Iowa-class vessel? There are only three docks in the western half of the nation that can hold her. And two of them are owned by the Navy. One's in Pearl, which doesn't even have a commercial connection anymore. The other one's in Puget Sound, which has nose-to-tail Navy work. And the other one is a commercial dock in Portland, where I have to get her across the bar. You know, it's a pretty big discussion. And then we have friends down at Lytton Ingalls, and they have, a $35 billion backlog of Navy vessel construction. And they can't find enough people to help build them. You know, they're really out of people.
Yeah, I mean, the shipbuilding issue is big. You know, you look at the West Coast, go look at Vigor in Oregon. I mean, you see that yard jammed. It's jammed right now. So, you know, there's criticism of U.S. commercial carriers going to China to get ship repairs done. They can't get into U.S. yards because the U.S. yards are so busy with government contracts. And if I'm a commercial, if I'm Matson or if I'm Pasha or if I'm one of the big commercial shippers in the United States, I need a guarantee from a shipyard. I'm going to bring my ship in on day one. I need to have it out on day 30. If you can't meet that schedule, I got to go somewhere else because I need ship on day 31 to go load in Long Beach. And I need to go. I don't have time to mess around. I'd rather pay the 50% tax on doing it overseas. And if I'm going to go overseas, China's going to be the cheapest because China labor is the cheapest, steel is the cheapest. Everything is subsidized. It's either direct or indirect subsidies. And by the way, we're letting China, you know, basically play on ships that we're going to need in case of a war. So, you know, when we start talking about these ideas about, well, has something happened to a ship? Is there a potential for some sort of sabotage of some kind? Well, when a ship is dropped off in China, they require sometimes the crew to leave. And so we don't know what's being done in the control systems at times. Wow. So, you know, this is a huge national security issue. And you know, I'm a big advocate for the U.S. Merchant Marine. But I think what we need to have is a discussion about reform, both on Navy shipbuilding and commercial shipbuilding. I'm not 100% we need to build, you know, everything needs to be 100% shipped on U.S. flags. That's ridiculous. It's crazy. The world has changed. But we do need to have this kind of conversation. And one of the things I'm very optimistic about these days is that the Navy is coming around. They're really starting to realize that there is a connection between the two, the commercial side and the Navy side. Secretary Del Toro, Secretary of Navy, right now has really been advocating that a lot.
Yeah. Again, you're speaking the same language. I did research just for that conference last year. I think out of the top 10 largest dry docks in the world, I want to say 7 or 8 were Chinese. You know, no question about it. So there's limited capability here. Of course, there's some other discussions on the BRAC group. But we won't even get into that today. But yeah, there's a ton of need here. It really is broad.
It's an extremely fascinating topic that really doesn't kind of reach the public ears. Most of the time that you're just going to the store and picking up what you need, or you're seeing what you see about the safety side and the defense side of what's going on in the world, but you never really see the merchant marine or shipping or commerce side that affects all of our lives. So
I have a running gag joke I do when I give talks and everything. I said we all learned about the disruption to the supply chain when all of a sudden you went to the store and there was no toilet paper, and that kind of hit us right where we live, you know. And it's like you know, when you have a disruption in shipping and in supply, you know, it can materialize in ways you never quite expect. And, you know, we live in a just-in-time style of logistics, both in terms of commercial and the military. And this is the problem I have with the military, is they've adopted that style. And it's very easy to disrupt, you know. And the way we disrupted toilet paper is by everyone being at home. And because everybody was at home, they weren't using commercial toilet paper. And that created the imbalance. All of a sudden, I needed the 2-ply at home 24/7 versus maybe half the time that I need it. And that creates an imbalance. And what we see is it's very easy to throw off shipping. One of the things I think the Chinese have learned very, very, you know, scientifically that they've been doing is if you look at the global supply chain, kind of like the circulatory system of your body, you know, they've learned how to apply pressure at key little points that can cause, you know, if I pinch your finger, it's okay. It's not significant, but if I do it long enough, you're going to lose the finger. Yep. You know, if I cut blood off long enough, and they know that. And you know, if you apply pressure at different areas, they realize that. And that's the danger of something like we're seeing right now with the Ukrainians versus the Russians. I mean, the fact that the Ukrainians have been able to drive the Russian Navy across the Black Sea by using nothing but Sea-Doos and drones, you know, it's basically, let me repurpose some jet skis, and I'm going to drive off the Russian Navy. And then you see the Houthi, who have the backing of the Iranians and sophisticated weapons, and what they're able to do and divert 50% of trade going through the Red Sea, the Bab el-Mandeb, and the Gulf of Aden, I think that's really significant. And again, you know, the problem we have is we have a very small footprint of a Navy. You know, committing four destroyers and a carrier battle group to the Red Sea, is that's not a long-term solution. That's going to be a problem. We're not going to be able to maintain that.
Yeah, very taxing. You get it.
Yeah, and it's going to wear them out, and it becomes a big problem because, you know, one of the things we learned from piracy back in the day of sail is you have to apply not just military force, but also that political force.
Right.
So you have to give them a way out. And so, yeah. But the way you get a better deal is by applying military force.
Yeah. Carry a big stick.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I mentioned our leadership summit from last year. This year's topic is more kind of close to home in that we have some world stage events coming up, Olympics, World Cup, things of that nature, where you're going to have swarms of people coming to Los Angeles. If you have an imbalance in any of those different areas related to the supply chain or the health and safety or transportation side of things in the city, how does that affect the other industries? And so that's kind of where our conversation this year is being built around, is how do you bring in people from all those perspectives and say, how are you preparing and empowering others and building relationships with key partners to make sure that you don't create that imbalance to where, should disaster strike when you have a huge influx of people in the city, it doesn't all break down.
And also parallel to that is, of course, the DISCA, Defense Support of Civilian Agencies. And it really is critical. If there's a major earthquake or some other natural disaster here in L.A., everybody will be looking to the Navy. That's all there is to it. They will be looking to them to bring in whatever they need. We're actually experts at landing helicopters here. Of all things I would have never imagined, you know, we actually are participating in that. We do the DISCA drill for L.A. now during L.A. Fleet Week. It's just, it's really an interesting position to be in.
The presidential visit was fun because they did a practice. They were going to fly him in, and they brought in the whole thing. They brought in three Ospreys and two Marine Ones. It was pretty cool.
Yeah, it's amazing how they don't have all the relationships. And to be fair to everybody in the military, people are rotating out. So all of those relationships change. So it's always there. So this is fun. I'd love to have more conversation.
Yeah,
we got to have you back, Sal.
Yeah, we have some other ideas too. We'll talk offline, but really fascinating stuff.
Well, listen, I'm happy to help and support you guys in any way and everything.
Same goes for you.
You know, you guys do with Iowa and with the Historical Naval Ship Association is great. So, you know, it's amazing, you know, and the amount of attention, you know, I've never thought I'd see so much battleship news going on with Texas and New Jersey moving and everything like that.
Yeah.
You guys are better than aircraft. You got more battleships at sea than aircraft carriers.
Right.
Which is good to see back in the day.
And we got a turning turret over here, so we're all good.
I mean, that's the thing. If you guys can, you know, show off in any way. I've actually been, believe it or not, I've been on every battleship of yours. I've been
on.
I was on Wisconsin, Missouri when they were actually out in the Gulf in the last tour back in the 90s. So I was on them and been up on New Jersey, up in Camden. I've been in Massachusetts and Alabama and Texas.
Yeah, my dad is a Massachusetts sailor, so
that's
the home home battleship in some ways for me.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm serious, but one of the things I've talked about doing is like almost like a battlefield tour. I got buddies who do battlefield tours in Europe and everything like that. And my dream is to put together one and run it up and down the, you know, one of the coasts or do something and hit a couple of ships and just use, you know, use Constitution, use Constellation, you know, John Brown and Monitor and Merrimack down there at Mariners and just run it. Cause I think it'd be a lot of fun. I think you could do it interactively too. I think, you know, the fact that, you know, not everybody can get to the East Coast too, which makes the West Coast, you guys really essential for that is really a lot of fun.
Yeah. This is fun. We'll have more.
Yeah. All right.
Cool.
Well, thank you, guys.
Well, it's good to meet you and good to talk to you and everything. And anything I can do to help support you, just give me a shout.
Yeah. Same goes for you. We'll be letting people know about your podcast and we'll put a link to you in the description and all that good stuff. So we'll see you.
That's
again.
Good. And if Ever Forward comes in again, just throw some bumpers out. just to be some really big bumpers. Yeah. Really big bumpers on the side.
Exactly. All right. Awesome. So thank you guys again for tuning into Scuttlebutt. We'll be back with more podcasts. If you want to get in touch with us, podcast@labattleship.com. Hit us up, leave us some comments and questions. I'm sure we're going to get some good ones on this podcast. So thanks for tuning in and we'll catch you on the next Scuttlebutt.